Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about Natalie Wood. Between the fact that Natalie Wood began her career as a young child, the fact that that childhood was dictated by an outrageous mother, and the fact that her life ended under tragic and mysterious circumstances, this will be a two-part episode. Maybe even three parts. Seriously, her childhood alone is a wild ride. I used a fantastic biography titled Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography by Suzanne Finstead as my primary source for this story. And it has everything. So today, I will tell you about Natalie's childhood, her life as a child star, and her relationship with her controlling mother. And then I'll return next week to talk about her transition into adulthood, how her career and life changed, and her relationships. And I'm thinking there will be a part three because her death and the circumstances surrounding it will require a lot of discussion alone. So please bear with me. I just don't want to skim over anything that I feel is important to her story and legacy. Before I dive in, I would like to give a warm welcome and a very big thank you to our newest Patreon member. Thank you to longtime supporter of the show, Kieran. You may have heard me read one or two of his shining reviews on the show in previous months. Well, now Kieran has become an Oscar-tier Patreon member and entered into a world full of fun bonus content. Lucky duck, huh? Well, you can be just as lucky. For the monthly price of a coffee and a donut, you can gain access to a vast library of fun and interesting Stars of the Golden Age bonus content. And the peace of mind in knowing that you are supporting this little indie podcast. Listen at the end of the show to learn more. Thank you so, so much, Kieran. Now, let's dive into the heartbreaking life of Natalie Wood. I apologize in advance. This is not going to be a very fun ride. Natalie Wood was born as Natalia Nikolaevna Zahadinko to parents Marusia or Maria and Nikolai or Nick, both Russian immigrants. I want to set a little groundwork with Maria before we get into Natalie's life. You'll see why pretty soon. Natalie's mother, Maria, was described as feverishly imaginative and a pathological liar in the book Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography. After learning more about Maria myself, I could add about a dozen more adjectives to that list describing her. And none of them would be very complimentary. Maria even claimed to be related to the famous Romanov royal family. She also claimed to have become a Chinese princess during her time in China after she fled Russia. I read time and time again that one could never trust a word that came out of Maria's mouth as truth. It was almost always highly engaging and very entertaining, but most of the stories she told of her life were nothing more than wild, colorful, tall tales. Maria immigrated to the United States with her first husband, Alexei, and their little girl, Olga, in 1930 in order to escape communism. They settled in San Francisco. Actually, Alexei had made the voyage about 10 months before Maria and Olga did. By the time Maria and Olga arrived in California, after a long and grueling voyage, Alexei had informed his wife that he had taken a mistress and he had no intentions of ending the romantic relationship with her. He told Maria he was a very passionate man and he simply could not go almost a year without a woman, as he just had to do. Eventually, Maria began her own affairs, including with the man that would become Natalie Wood's father, Nikolai Zahodinko, also a Russian immigrant. Maria had grown up with some privilege. At least most biographers believe so. But again, we can't trust anything she's actually said. But when she arrived in San Francisco, she entered into a life of poverty, far away from home. To escape this new reality, like many people did, she went to the movies. According to her oldest daughter, Olga, Maria would take the family's precious grocery money and go to the cinema alone. She dreamed of stardom for herself. Both having romantic relationships outside of their marriage, Alex and Maria divorced in 1935, and Maria started a new life with Nikolai, and still continued to have other affairs. Still, Nick and Maria got married on February 8, 1938. And 5.5 months later, on July 20th, 1938, Natalie gave birth to her second daughter, a child she knew from the moment she began developing inside of the womb was something extraordinary. She believed this mostly because a gypsy fortune teller had assured her of it. That same fortune teller, according to family legend, told Maria that her daughter would one day meet a tragic end as the result of a drowning. Maria wasn't alone in her immediate obsession over her newborn daughter, whom they called Natasha. Her father, Nick, who had now changed the family's last name to Gurdon, was just as spellbound by his little girl, and very, very protective. If he allowed people to come close to her in those early months of her life, he required them to wear a mask whenever near her. Nick's protective nature spilled over into domination and control often. He was a strict husband and father, requiring his stepdaughter Olga and his daughter Natasha to curtsy and never ask questions. He did have an affection for vodka, though, which only made these traits worse. Natalie later recalled that when he was sober, he could be very loving. But when he was drinking, he was very, very difficult to be around. It sounds like he had two completely different personalities, the one fueled by vodka and the one not. Poor Olga, Maria's firstborn child, was left to pretty much fend for herself now that Natasha was the sole purpose of her mother's existence. Olga was 10 years old when her little sister was born, and she was pushed aside the second her baby sister came into the world. Unless she was needed to babysit. She was actually the only person Nick and Maria trusted to babysit Natasha. You would think Olga would be resentful of this lack of equal love and attention, but she didn't seem to feel that at all. She adored her baby sister, There was no way she could not love her. She was so sweet and so adorable. An old soul, even from a very young age, Olga would later say. As an escape from Nick's rampages, as Olga called them, she and little Natasha would create makeshift stages and sets and put on plays for neighbors and family, or just dance and sing, whatever they could do to temporarily escape the violent realities of an alcoholic parent. Mostly an escape for Olga, since she was much older than Natasha and understood more about what was happening. She was protecting her little sister and herself. From the age of 2, Natasha just went along with whatever escape Olga took them into. She wanted to do whatever her big sister did. Olga was a loving and protective big sister. This escape for emotional survival led to Olga wanting to seriously pursue a life in the performing arts. But Maria was more focused on getting her younger daughter into that life. As Natasha grew, her mother continued to be obsessively consumed with the idea that her daughter was extraordinarily unique and destined for unparalleled greatness. That she was going to be a great star one day. Natalie later said, quote, "When we walked down the street, mother would put coins on the sidewalk when I wasn't looking, and when I found them, she'd tell me it was magic, and that I was destined to be someone magical. For years, I believed in magic," end quote. And in reference to Maria's molding of her daughter, a friend later said, quote, "She brainwashed her that she was this special child," end quote. Maria would hypnotize her little girl, pushing mental images of stardom into her mind, while also promoting a great fear of water. Maria was terrified of the premonition of drowning the fortune teller had given her when she was pregnant with Natasha, and she did whatever she could to shower those fears right on down onto her daughter. She created such a sense of paranoia and fear in her young daughter that Natasha was even scared to have her hair washed or to take a bath. Maria completely manipulated her very impressionable, growing child's developing mind. Even Maria herself later said, "God created her, but I invented her." As if the unpredictability of her father and the damaging manipulation of her mother weren't bad enough, the family also moved often. So Natasha didn't have an ounce of stability or consistency in her life. By the time she was 3 years old, the family had moved 4 times. In the fall of 1942, with the U.S. now deep into World War II and Maria and Nick just as poor as they'd always been, Maria saw a little cottage in Santa Rosa that she just had to have. She didn't care that they had no money. She was the type of woman that if she wanted something, she was going to make sure she got it. So she stopped in and learned that the owner of the cottage was in a deep despair because his wife had left him for the carpenter that he'd hired to fix the place up. Well, Maria knew a good target when she saw it. And a heartsick man was just that, a good target. She turned on her charm and manipulated the owner of the cottage perfectly. She convinced him into selling the place to her for a $100 down payment. That would be just under $2,000 today. Every last penny Maria and Nick had. She promised him she would secure a loan for the rest of it. Olga had been present when this deal took place. "She conned him into it," she said. "I think he even gave her money to buy furniture." It's uncertain if Maria knew this little nugget of information or not before deciding she had to have that cottage. But Alfred Hitchcock was in Santa Rosa filming Shadow of a Doubt at that exact moment in time. And with that, now living right in the center of the action, Maria began dragging her adorable future star of a daughter, Natasha, to all of the filming locations and got herself centered as close to the crew and brilliant director as possible. Hitchcock didn't fall into Maria's trap. But the next director to show up in Santa Rosa did, after much butting in and pushing on Maria's part. The movie was Happy Land, starring Don Ameche and directed by Irving Pichel. Maria put her stage mom antics into overdrive. She wasn't going to allow another movie to slip through her fingers without her little 4-year-old starlet getting in front of those cameras. She groomed Natasha and how to approach and what to say to director Irving Pichel, and told her to not take no for an answer. Pichel knew instantly what was happening, and he felt so bad for little Natasha. But he also thought she was the sweetest, most adorable thing he'd ever seen. So he gave her a tiny, non-speaking cameo in Happy Land. This was Natalie Wood's film debut. It was a tiny snippet of screen time, but it was screen time. At the end of filming, director Irving Pichel gave Nick and Maria some stern advice. Keep your daughter as far away from Hollywood as possible. It is not a good life for a child. But, of course, Maria did not care to listen to this advice. Her daughter was going to be a Hollywood star. And then Maria began corresponding through letters with Pichel, pretending to be her now barely 5-year-old daughter writing to him, a child who could not yet read or write. I would love to see what those letters looked like. This woman was something. Unfortunately, Maria's manipulation and control of her daughter left a lot of damage in its wake. A lot. Natalie later said of her mother's grooming from such a young age, quote, "I learned at an early age that if you are nice to men, you can get anything you want from them," end quote. And she said she always, always did what she was told. This is just one example of the damage Maria had instilled in her daughter, the way she portrayed how the world worked to her child. The saddest part is that Natalie just wanted to be a kid. She wanted friends and fun and exploration. She was allowed to have one friend, aside from her sister, who was 10 years older than her. Maria allowed her to have a friendship with a little boy who lived across the street, Edwin. But even that friendship was strictly overseen. Natasha was completely controlled and manipulated and stripped of her childhood because a fortune teller said that her destiny was fame and greatness. And Maria was making sure that she was raised with that and only that in mind, getting her to that stardom. Although it was Maria who had insisted the family settle in that little cottage in Santa Rosa, Santa Rosa was way too far away from where Maria really needed to be to secure her daughter's fate as a movie star. She needed to get Natasha closer to where the magic was happening. She needed to get her to Hollywood. So in the spring of 1944, Maria made the family uproot once again and relocate to yet another new home in another new town. Get a load of the announcement she placed in the Santa Rosa newspaper before the family left town. Quote, 6-year-old SR girl going to Hollywood for role in movies. Little Natasha Gurdon, 6-year-old daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Nicholas S. Gurdon of 2168 Humboldt Street, will leave shortly, probably about the first of the week, for Hollywood and her chance at a motion picture career. End quote. It went on to suggest that director Irving Pichel had handpicked Natalie to become his newest star, and that she could be seen on the silver screen very soon and very often. Maria really wanted everyone in Santa Rosa to think that there was a contract and film career anxiously awaiting her little Natasha. That she was chosen out of all the children in the whole world to be the next child movie star. When the family left Santa Rosa bound for Hollywood, Natasha was just shy of 6 years old. And it marked the end of what small childhood she was allowed to have. Childhood was over. She was ripped from her home and her only friend. None of that mattered anymore, according to Maria. She was going to be a star. And that expectation, the idea that the entire family was packing up and moving over 400 miles away so she could become a famous movie star, was a lot of pressure to put on a six-year-old child. And she definitely felt it. There they were in Hollywood in June of 1944, with no home, no money, no jobs, but a lot of sheer certainty that their golden child, Natasha, would change all of their lives, and maybe even change the world. Maria finagled her way into the small apartment occupied by a former dance teacher of Olga's. This woman must really have been the most masterful manipulator to ever exist. She moved her family of four in with this woman. But it would be temporary, of course, because Natasha was going to be a movie star very soon, Maria would say. Not if it was up to director Irving Pichel, though. And Maria really thought he was going to be their meal ticket, their ticket to the top. Pichel knew all too well what life was like for a child actor. Working in the business usually means the end of childhood, and he didn't want that for Natasha. And nor should her parents. But Maria didn't care about any of that. She wanted her daughter to be a star, period. Pichel really didn't want to be the one to help her get there, though. But Maria was brutally persistent and very manipulative. She would not leave the man alone, and she even used Natasha as a pawn, having her telephone him and beg for a part. When she finally did get an audition, she didn't do great. It was a really emotional part, and she couldn't quite deliver the emotional trauma that the part required. So, her mother trained her how to cry on cue. Actually, she first ordered older sister Olga to do it. So, Olga told Natalie to think about the day that their beloved dog was tragically killed in the street. It worked. Then Maria stepped in and took it one ugly step further. At auditions, she would describe in detail the act of pulling the wings off of a bird. Or, worse yet, she would physically take a butterfly out of a jar that she brought with her and tear its wings off right in front of her daughter. Horrible. And it, of course, worked very well at inducing tears. From that point on, Natasha felt a ton of anxiety and fear when she knew that she had to do a crying scene. It was very traumatic for her. Her mother did this to her. Her own mother. Just another trauma to add to Maria's big book of traumas. Irving Pichel finally gave in to Maria's hounding and cast Natasha in his movie Tomorrow is Forever with Orson Welles and Claudette Colbert. He knew Maria was going to stop at nothing to get her daughter into the movies, and he was afraid at what she might try next. At least he could protect the little girl, he thought. Maria wins. It was at this point that Natasha Gurdon officially became Natalie Wood, a change made in order to anglicize her name, something that was very commonly done. The name Wood was inspired by director Sam Wood. She would remain Natasha Gurdon legally, but for all intents and purposes, she would officially now be known as Natalie Wood. Natasha hated her new name. Natalie was put under even more severe pressure now that she had landed the role in Tomorrow is Forever. Pressure from her mother to be courteous, obedient, respectful, to never ever forget her lines, and to always do as told. Pressure to be absolutely perfect at all times. Because Natalie's performance in this movie would determine if she would be kept by Universal International Pictures under a 7-year contract or not. Natalie's first official male co-star, Orson Welles, was instantly blown away by her abilities as a child actress. He referred to her talent as, quote, terrifying, and said, quote, I've had a lot of experience with child actors, but Natalie was far and away the most memorable, even more so than Liz Taylor. She was a professional when I first saw her. I guess she was born a professional. End quote. Maybe it seemed so, but I think a more accurate analysis would be that she was born to be the moldable putty in her mother's controlling hands. She was forced to be obedient and perfect, and that came across to others as professional. That professionalism landed Natalie that 7-year film contract with Universal that her mother had wanted so badly. Her starting salary was $125 per week, or about $2,000 per week today, and it would increase every year until reaching $750 per week, or about $9,400 per week today, in her final contracted year. As you can imagine, Maria was very happy about this. Maria got her payday. She got to live the life she dreamed of living vicariously through her daughter. But Natalie was not happy. She missed her best friend Edwin back in Santa Rosa, her only friend. And she missed just being a child. She missed peace and freedom. She was surrounded by people constantly now. The only time she ever got alone was in her bed at night. Every waking hour was spent surrounded by adults, especially now that her mother was instilling a fear of potential kidnappings into her as well, now that she was an actress. She wasn't allowed to have any child friends. She was under constant adult watch. Debilitating anxiety was brewing in the young girl, fueled mostly by her own mother, and every decision Maria made for her daughter's life added to it. Natalie was put to work right away with her contract and was immediately a busy child star in Hollywood. When she wasn't working on a film production, she was in dance or piano lessons. Maria was going to make sure her daughter was capable in every talent possible. She told her, "No matter what they ask you, you can sing, dance, swim, ride. Always say yes. You can learn later." Since Natalie was Maria's number one priority, older sister Olga was stripped of her own voice lessons, which were very important to her and the future that she wanted for herself. Maria wouldn't allow it anymore. So, Olga just secured babysitting and department store jobs and paid for her singing lessons herself. I really don't know how Olga kept a positive attitude throughout this childhood she had under Natalie's shadow, but she seemed to keep one and she was very proud of her little sister's success. She suffered a lot of personal sacrifices for it, though. And where was Natalie's father, Nick, during this quick rise to fame that his daughter was experiencing? Well, he was just living the life that his wife instructed him to live and allowed her to do what she needed to do, from the sounds of it. Nick was working at the studio, thanks to Maria's forcefulness in getting him a job there, and he should be happy for that, she thought. Nick was described as miserably unhappy. So basically, everyone in the Gurdon family was unhappy except Maria. Maria was on top of the world. And then, Maria was expecting another baby. Nick was definitely not happy about this. In fact, Olga walked into the house one day to find Nick holding a knife to her mother's pregnant belly. It was not a pretty situation. Baby Svetlana Gurdon was born on March 1, 1946, when Natalie was 7 years old. Do you think a brand new baby would relieve Natalie of some of her controlling mother's tight leash? Nope. The moment Maria returned home from the hospital with her newborn daughter, Lana, she handed her over to 16-year-old Olga. Olga was forced to drop out of high school to raise her newborn baby sister. Maria couldn't be bothered. She had a child movie star to focus on. Olga eventually convinced her mother to hire a nanny to care for the baby, on Natalie's dime, I assume. When Maria fired that nanny, she forced Nick to quit his job and take care of Lana, and he wasn't the most qualified for the job either. And at that point, when Nick left the workforce, 7-year-old Natalie was the official sole breadwinner for her entire family of five. Natalie suffered greatly from anxiety throughout her life and she eventually recognized this as stemming from the pressure to succeed from her very first years of life, especially once her family arrived in Hollywood and they were depending solely on her for their survival. The point when Nick quit his job and the family's only other source of income vanished marked a time when Natalie's anxieties soared to new heights. She was under extreme pressure to make it as a star, and she felt that pressure every second of every day. She was constantly reminded that her family's survival depended on her success as an actress. She was riddled with anxiety at just 7 years old. The pressure grew so intense that by the winter after she turned 8, she suffered from temporary paralysis that her parents feared was polio. But it turned out to be a psychological response to the trauma and intense anxiety and pressure that she was constantly under. How sad is that? She was 8 years old. Natalie Wood's reception was good in her first films in Hollywood. Luella Parsons, whose opinion mattered almost more than anybody else's in the business, said she was remarkable and would eat your heart out. The first movies weren't giant hits, but Natalie sure seemed to be. And then came the beginning phases of a low-budget little picture Fox was making in the fall of 1946 when Natalie was 8 years old, a Christmas movie. Fox wasn't putting much energy into the movie as they didn't expect for it to be much of a success at all. But Maria knew that the story was unique and special, and that the role of the little girl in the movie was something she had to get Natalie cast in. So she had Natalie emulate Hollywood's number one child star of the time, Margaret O'Brien, and be her in every way during her screen test. Look like her, talk like her, move like her. Maria put intense pressure on Natalie to secure this particular role in this movie, even though she was about to start filming another movie at the same time, The Ghost and Mrs. Muir. Maria's pressure worked. Natalie got the part in that Christmas film. The movie was Miracle on 34th Street. I did a bonus episode over on Patreon this month all about the production of Miracle on 34th Street. It's pretty interesting if you want to head on over and join so you can check it out. I'll talk a little about it today, but you can find some fun behind-the-scenes stuff on that bonus episode if you're interested. Here's what I'll say about Miracle on 34th Street today, though, as we talk about Natalie Wood. It was a very happy film shoot. The cast and crew became like family, and the whole experience was sprinkled with happiness and positivity. Two things Natalie Wood did not know from her family life. Natalie Wood was 8 years old, and she sincerely thought actor Edmund Gwenn, who played Santa Claus, was actually Santa Claus. She developed a very sweet relationship with both Edmund Gwenn and her on-screen mother, Maureen O'Hara, during the production of Miracle on 34th Street. Natalie's own mother was a pretty rotten mother, as you now know. Not much love and nurturing going on there. And Natalie found those missing qualities in Maureen O'Hara. And Maureen O'Hara felt just as much love and compassion for Natalie as Natalie did for her. They developed a very special mother-daughter bond, something Natalie really needed. Although Miracle on 34th Street was made as a B film at Fox, everyone involved in it knew it was something special. They all knew they were a part of something magical, much of this being attributed to the magic of Edwin Gwenn himself as Santa Claus. He was the soothing foundation for the whole movie, the heart of the cast and crew. During filming on Miracle on 34th Street, 8-year-old Natalie Wood became known as One Take Natalie. She had a photographic memory, and not only easily memorized her own lines, but always knew her co-star's lines too if they forgot them. Everyone loved working with her. When Miracle on 34th Street was released in June of 1947, it made Natalie Wood an instant star. She was a hit. Just about perfect, according to Luella Parsons. 20th Century Fox had borrowed Natalie from her contracted studio, Universal International. And after her success in Miracle, they wanted to lure her away and sign her to Fox bad. Universal wasn't willing to let her go from her 7-year contract. They knew what they had in her. So Miss Manipulation Maria devised a plan. She coached Natalie to go to the head of Universal and cry to him that she didn't want to be in the movies anymore. She just wanted to be a little girl. Could he please let her go from her contract so she can just be a typical child? How can a grown man say no to that from a sweet little girl? Universal let Natalie Wood out of her contract so she could be a happy little girl living a happy, normal childhood life. But Maria marched her right on over to 20th Century Fox and presented her daughter to them on a silver platter. You can imagine how happy Maria was when Natalie was signed to a 7-year contract with Fox with a starting salary of $800 per week, increasing to $3,300 by the end of her contract. Remember, she was making $125 per week at Universal. That $800 starting weekly salary would adjust to about $11,600 per week today. And her eventual weekly salary of $3,300 that she would work up to, adjusting to about $40,000 per week today. Maria was happy indeed. Natalie went to public school for just a little bit during her first months in Hollywood, when she wasn't actively working on movies. But otherwise, her education was conducted on the studio lot. And I have a really hard time attaching the word education to this, because she wasn't really getting one. This should come as no surprise at all, but Maria manipulated and threatened the studio teachers into giving Natalie A's and B's without having completed the actual work. No homework, no tests. Maria just wanted those good grades to keep in line with the child labor rules. She didn't think her child needed the knowledge being taught at school. Not when she was going to be a movie star. All she needed to know was how to read so she could read her scripts. Nothing else was important, according to Maria. As a teacher, I think you can assume how this makes me feel. My heart rate rose considerably as I read about this in Natalie's biography. I'm a pretty chill person, but this woman infuriates me. Public school would have been such a gift to Natalie because it could have offered her at least a little fragment of life of a typical child. Typical experiences and typical friendships. Instead, she became friends with adults on movie sets. She didn't know how to be a kid. She later said, quote, "I did feel a bit of a misfit then during that period because I was so comfortable with adults and rather uncomfortable with kids, having not been around very many." End quote. Because her mother wouldn't allow her to be around any children. Her purpose wasn't to play with other children. It was to work with adults and make money. Older sister Olga was having her own struggles with keeping up with her education since their mother didn't seem to think it was a priority at all. Maria had used Natalie's money to buy a bigger house, which meant moving from Hollywood to Burbank. Which also meant changing schools for Olga. Olga was a senior in high school at Hollywood High, and she was very involved in the musical theater there. She had a community. She had the only sense of stability in her life at school. But Maria first made her leave school to raise her infant sister, and then she tried to force Olga from her high school again when Maria decided that they were moving to Burbank. It was at this point when Olga put her foot down. She decided to officially separate herself from her toxic and controlling mother, the mother who hadn't cared a bit about her in years. Although busy with school and the school theater, she worked hard at a department store and took on more babysitting jobs so she could afford to rent a room on her own, just to stay in school. She wasn't leaving her life at Hollywood High. Her classmates and her theater group was the only family she had. When it came time for Olga to graduate in June of 1947, she did so without a single member of her family there to cheer her on. Nick was too drunk to drive the family to the ceremony, so they didn't go. Olga graduated alone. Nick and Maria's relationship became increasingly abusive and toxic after little Lana was born. Lana later recalled her first memories of childhood being of her parents fighting. And not just yelling at each other fighting. Nick chasing Maria around with a gun kind of fighting. Maria yelling at Natalie and Lana to hide or run from him. Nick was drinking often, and he was a mean and violent drinker. This is complete speculation by people close to Natalie, but it is believed that she was likely sexually abused by her father. Robert Blake began as a child actor alongside Natalie, and they became close friends. Here's what he said. Quote, "I never talked to her about it, but I always got that feeling. Coming from that place myself, I can usually smell those kinds of people. Being in show business was never her problem. That was her solution. Her problem was away from the camera. Her problem was a thing called family, love, security. I think the camera became her parents. It was her security blanket." End quote. Natalie's first serious boyfriend, an actor named Scott Marlowe, said this, quote, "All the signs were there. She would never say anything about anybody. I've suspected her father. I've suspected a lot of people, a lot of producers. I suspected Irving Pichel even. You just don't know with that mother," end quote. The tragedy here, the idea that people who knew Natalie well knew her to be closed off, is that it is a clear indicator that Maria was such a cloud of threat over her, and that Natalie's parents had her so conditioned that she knew to keep her traumatic family life private. She maybe even thought what happened in her family was what happened in most families. She became a prisoner in her own mind. She closed off to the world. Her poor little soul was trapped within the confines of control, manipulation, emotional abuse, and possibly even sexual abuse. I struggled with even bringing up the claims by others of potential sexual abuse because Natalie or her sisters never made the claim themselves, as far as I'm aware. In fact, they believe their father was also a victim of Maria's domineering control. They expressed their love for him and had compassion for him. Natalie and her younger sister, Lana, believed any violent behavior Nick demonstrated was a direct result of Maria's instigation. It's just a really difficult situation, and of course nobody knows what the experiences in that household were actually like. What we do know is that it was far, far from happy and nurturing. What happened in that household definitely did not help Natalie's growing fears and paranoia and anxieties. And it would leave her with a lifelong fear of confrontations, even minor ones. It left her with a lot of triggers. Every part of her childhood set her up for a lifetime of emotional struggles. Now that Maria has Natalie firmly planted at 20th Century Fox and is raking in that big, juicy paycheck, Natalie got right to work fulfilling her contracted duties. A couple of her first movies under her Fox contract were Chicken Every Sunday and Father Was a Fullback, where she was able to team back up with her Miracle on 34th Street mother, Maureen O'Hara, also starring Fred McMurray. She was lent out to RKO for The Green Promise in the fall of 1948, now 10 years old. And it proved to be a very traumatic film shoot for her. Remember, Maria had instilled a very intense fear of water in her daughter. Well, The Green Promise contained a scene that took place in a terrible nighttime thunderstorm, in which Natalie would have to cross a wooden bridge over a raging river. In reality, the scene was shot on the studio lot with wind machines and huge propellers blowing rain onto the set. There was simulated thunder, lightning, and electrical explosions. But if you have seen the movie or watched the scene on YouTube, it was clearly a miserable scene for her to do. And when you add in her extreme fear of water, it becomes just plain crushing. Because when she is crossing that wooden bridge over the raging river, and studio lot or not, that water is really raging under the bridge. A mistake was made by the crew. The bridge was supposed to collapse the second Natalie makes it to the other side. Natalie was terrified to do this scene going over the water, but her mother promised her that she would be okay and that nothing bad was going to happen to her. I read two accounts. One that her mother told her the bridge would collapse once she was safely on the other side, and one that said nobody ever told her the bridge was set to collapse at all. Whichever is true, it isn't what happened. The bridge collapsed before Natalie had made it to the end, and she was left clinging to safety, barely, while being pummeled with wind and rain, with dangerous water rushing underneath. When you watch it, you can tell how difficult it was for her to grab on for dear life in order to avoid falling in and being swept up by the aggressive current. A little girl terrified of water that doesn't even like her hair washed. The director's response? Keep the cameras rolling. Keep the mother back. He chose a scene for a movie over the physical safety and mental well-being of a child. Natalie's wrist was broken during that scene as she fell from the bridge and clung to the edge while water rushed under her, threatening to sweep her up with it. Her wrist was broken, and Maria forced her to conceal her injury so they could finish making the movie. Even after filming was completed, Maria refused to take Natalie to a doctor. Maria did not like doctors. She didn't trust them. And most likely, she was worried that they would see that the injury had occurred weeks earlier. It could be bad for business. It could be bad for Maria. It was indeed very, very bad for Natalie. It was just another traumatic experience that added to her severely tarnished emotional development. Her fear of water was amplified, and her ability to trust was diminished. This is where I'm going to leave off for this week. I'm not positive yet, but this is probably going to end up being our first ever three-part story. When I first began, I didn't expect to find such horrible information about Natalie's childhood, but sadly I did. And for me, childhood is the most important part of our stars' lives. So when I can find such detailed information about a childhood, I want to really dive into that. Because it is the childhood experiences that really set the foundation for future struggles or triumphs in life. Little pieces of my heart have chipped away as I've taken the journey through Natalie's childhood. She was robbed of so much. She was harmed so much by the one person who was supposed to protect her. It's just so heartbreaking. We are leaving Natalie today at only 10 years old. And we still have a lot to talk about. So it'll take as long as it takes, but we are going to give her the recognition she deserves. Before I sign off, I want to share a review of the week. This is such a sweet 5-star review left from Hugh. He wrote, quote, I just listened to the Young Ladies podcast on Rita Hayworth. It was very informative and touching to the heart. It showed me the dysfunctionality amongst the people that are worshipped by society. The young lady spoke clearly with the voice of an angel. I was impressed with her empathy towards Rita and how at the end of the podcast she gave resource numbers for those that need counseling. End quote. Thank you, Hugh. I was able to touch base with Hugh via email, too. And he said he loves to listen to the podcast as an escape from world events and news or when stuck in traffic. I flick on your podcast and disappear, he said. Thank you so much, Hugh. And although I sound young and feel young, I'm not super young. Young at heart, I guess. I love disappearing into these stories as well, just like you guys do. I love getting in my time machine and traveling back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s pretty much every single day. Because I'll be honest with you, I don't really like living in today's world. I never have, pretty much my whole life. I've always wanted to live in a different time. I embrace it because I love life so dang much. but I would love to have a real time machine and go back to a simpler time. I know it wasn't always pretty back then either, but at least technology wasn't overtaking the world. Santa's making his rounds tomorrow night. Maybe I'll find a shiny new time machine under my tree. Let me know if you want to take a ride with me. We can start by going back and saving Natalie from her mother. Thanks again, Hugh. I'm really happy the emotions I feel during my research are portrayed well in the final product. Some of these stories are a real emotional roller coaster, including this one today. But I think they are important stories to tell. Many of these stars have been so glamorized over the years as the Golden Age movie stars they were. But more often than not, there was a dark and painful side hiding under that glamour. And I'm here to share what I can with you so we can get the whole picture of our most beloved Golden Age stars. And maybe respect them a little more for what they went through and how that contributed to their craft. Oh, and Hugh also asked me about shirts. It's funny because I actually set up a merch store not long after I started this podcast in June of 2024, but I never actually shared it publicly. I just wanted it ready for that day, and I just wanted merch for myself to wear. So my mom and I have been sporting Stars of the Golden Age apparel for a year and a half now. I just didn't think anybody else was interested. But Hugh asked, so I'm going to officially make the Stars of the Golden Age apparel and other merchandise public very soon. I wore one of my Stars of the Golden Age shirts at preschool this week, actually. And one of my adorable 3-year-old little boys was admiring it and said, "I really love your shirt, Miss Erin. I think it's because there was a golden crown on it." So 3-year-olds like it, at least. And my mom at least pretends to. No, I know she does. So I'll let you know how to get that merchandise real soon. Thanks again also to Kieran for becoming an Oscar tier supporter on Patreon. So what does Kieran get for his monthly contribution to the show? Well, he gets a full bonus episode that covers some really interesting Golden Age topics. He gets a movie of the month recap episode each month, and he gets a cocktail party episode each month. This month's bonus episode took us behind the scenes of the making of Miracle on 34th Street, as I mentioned earlier. Last month, I took listeners on a trip behind the scenes of Golden Age Hollywood movie studios. The dressing rooms, the commissaries, the barbershops, the schools, the sound stages. It was really interesting and fun. For our movie of the month this month, we are watching The Bishop's Wife. Patrons can watch the movie in their own time, if they wish, and then I share a recap episode where I also share some fun facts about each movie. And then, my favorite, the monthly cocktail party. In these episodes, I share the recipe and history behind a vintage cocktail that we could have found our favorite Golden Age stars sipping on. And then I dig into my collection of old movie magazines and read some fun vintage celebrity gossip and other fun articles. This month, in addition to some tidbits from the gossip columns, I shared an article about a Christmas dinner party at Jean Harlow's house that was really fun. So all of that could be yours for just $8 per month. Plus, you get the entire back catalog of bonus content and all future content as long as you want to stick around. If that's a little steep for you, there's also the Emmy tier, which is $4 per month. And that gives you everything except for those full-length bonus episodes. But those bonus episodes are pretty interesting, so you probably don't want to miss out on them. And as long as you include your mailing address at sign up, I will also send you a Stars of the Golden Age sticker. And like Kieran, I will give you a thank you shout out on a future episode. I'll even send your sticker all the way to Ireland or beyond, like I did for Kieran. Come on over, please join us. I promise to keep you supplied with fun bonus content as a thank you for your support of the show. The more support this show gets, the longer I can keep presenting it to you. And I want to be able to do that for a long, long time. Patreon.com/Stars of the Golden Age Podcast. There's a link in the show notes that will take you right there. Thank you all so much for joining me for another week. And if this is your first episode, welcome. And I hope you stick around for more stories from the Golden Age of Hollywood. At least come back to hear the rest of Natalie Wood's story. Thanks, guys. reach for the positive in every day, be kind to everyone you encounter, and have a great rest of your week. Happy holidays, everyone. For this episode, I used a book titled Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography by Suzanne Finstead. This book is good, you guys. I also used the documentary Intimate Portrait, Natalie Wood, and IMDb.